Next case.
Washington et al. Against Pastara, as to the adversary of the appellant, are to be held to the appellant.
You may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Edwin Gadberry from Chesterfield County. Fortunate to represent Mr. and Mrs. Washington in this matter, who are residents of Prince George County, where this particular case occurred. This is a case of the plaintiff being an experienced investor, a man who had bought more than 50 properties as investment properties by his own characterization. He flipped property, bought it, and which, for people that don't watch HGTV, means that he bought it, improved it, and sold it for more than he paid for it. Smart business. He testified that he had bought 20 to 30 tax sale properties. This particular property was a delinquent tax sale by the County of Prince George. It was a particular bargain for him because he bought this property, which was assessed at about $37,000. He bought it for $11,000. He then commenced to demolish part of the first floor of the property and reconstruct it in the process of improving it. And then he was made aware by my clients that he was not on his own property, that he was in my client's house. My client did not live there, but he owned the house. As the record shows, it was formerly his mother's house that he had bought to hold on to. And he advised the plaintiff that he should stop work, and from there on, that's how we got to here. The issue in this case is a matter of whether the plaintiff had constructive notice or actual notice that he was in my client's property and not on his own. The most important exhibit in this case, in the appendix, page 115, is the Prince George County tax map. It's important because both parties put this same tax map into evidence. We put it in at page 115. I'm sorry, the plaintiff put it in first as part of their Exhibit 1. We put it in as our Exhibit 6, which is at page 166. It's virtually the same tax map. It's free. It's available on the Internet. You don't even have to leave home to see one. And by one additional click, our Exhibit 6 is the aerial photograph of the two properties. And this also is free. Anybody with a smartphone can go to the Prince George County website and take a look at this picture. And the picture, the northernmost property is the Washington property. The southernmost property is the Prasad property. They are different in size, and they are especially different in trees. The photographs introduced by the plaintiff at trial show from the road a clear view of the Washington house, and that's obvious in the overhead picture, too, that there are no trees in front of the house. Prasad's property that he actually bought is covered in trees. There's a picture of the structure that was on there, page 173 of the appendix, and maybe this structure plus the land is worth $11,000. There's obviously a lot of difference in the two.
Mr. Gadberry, when we're talking about either active or constructive notice, are we generally talking about what one would find if they do a title search, or are we talking about what one would find if they look anywhere, such as the tax maps? And if you do a title search, would you also get to the tax map, or is that extra?
In this case, you would get to the tax map because this was a tax sale. Anyone examined in title. Title was conveyed to Prasad by the County of Prince George, or by a special commissioner for the County of Prince George, because the previous owner didn't pay his real estate taxes, and the county went through the statutory procedures to give all the right notice and to advertise the sale. And then the deed essentially comes from the county or the special commissioner appointed by the circuit court of Prince George to convey title. you can't do a title search without going to that tax file. And I actually, at the trial, had the judge take judicial notice of the tax file. It was a rather thick file because you get a lot of notice papers in there. It was not disputed in the record that the proper tax parcel number for Prasad's property was stated 26 times in that tax sale file. So if someone had gone there, it would have been plain to them.
Counsel?
Yes, ma'am.
But it's not, I mean, technically speaking, it would not show up in the chain of title, the tax map. But obviously you should look at a tax map if you're doing a title search.
That's exactly right.
Okay. The second thing, though, is the document that you did mention is the plat in Prasad's chain of title, which is at Deed Book 178, page 396.
Yes,
I mean, that also would show a distinction between the three properties.
It does. And that's why we introduced that into evidence, because what that plat shows is that a private road crosses the Prasad property. That private road, I believe, is visible in the aerial photograph, and it shows up in virtually the identical place on that 1963 plat. Mr. Prasad chose, in dealing with the county on this, not to have a title examination. He chose not to be represented by an attorney in that transaction. His testimony was that he didn't feel he needed to, that he trusted the courts and he trusted the county. And that's nice. But Virginia is a caveat emptor state. The burden is on the buyer to do complete full inspection and due diligence, to use the vernacular, to kick the tires, slam the doors, and drive it around the block. It is not up to the seller to make any warranties. The contract in this case specifically excluded any warranties. It says this sale is as is, this property is being sold as is, with all faults. Anyone with any experience in real estate knows that when you see those words, that's a red flag. That means you really need to have a title examination, because the seller is not standing behind this property at all. What you see is only what you get. No warranties. It occurred to me in the research of this case, back to 1823, that for almost 200 years, people in Virginia have been building on other people's land. I guess in the rural areas that's easier to do because it's not always clear exactly where the lines are. But since 1823 in the Morris case that I cited in the brief, when people building on someone else's land who should have known better try to get their money back, this court has consistently said no.
Can I interrupt you there? That's a great point, because unjust enrichment law generally and quantum merit, which was the specific theory the trial court used, doesn't have a maximum that says if you are any way at fault, you can't recover. It's a very broad equitable concept, and that feeds into the arguments being made that this is a chancellor making a gut call based upon fairness and equity, since it's an equitable remedy. So are you advancing that this constructive and actual notice principle is unique to the application of equity to improvements on real estate, consistent with these cases? Or are you saying, in all cases of unjust enrichment, quantum merit, or whatever name you want to put on it, constructive trust, as a matter of law, if the provider of the unrequested value is in any way at fault, then the remedy is unavailable? Because that would be a bit of a stretch, I think.
Well, Your Honor, that is the doctrine of unclean hands. And that was my second point of argument in my brief, that he who seeks equity must come with clean hands, I believe is the ancient maxim. And in this case, Prasad made the mistake. He had all the information right there available to him. He bought a piece of property. He got something for his money.
But unclean hands is an equitable defense. It's not an element of the prima facie case of the complainant. Whereas the cases you cite in your argument in Simon Rivera number one, advances that under the unique application of these doctrines in Virginia to real estate and to property, that is part of the prima facie case that you not have constructive or actual notice, that you're putting the improvement on the wrong place. Do you see the distinction?
I do, Your Honor, and I agree with both premises. I agree with your characterization of the cases, but I also think unclean hands applies if you're asking for an equitable remedy. In this case, they didn't sue for money in terms of a simple debt. They sued for constructive trust, and thus the trial court ruled that this was a constructive trust, was appropriate for a constructive trust, and that's why my response is that no, it really wasn't appropriate for a constructive trust because the plaintiff was not unjustly enriched. He put himself where he was. He made mistakes, and those mistakes were not the plaintiff's fault, the defendant's fault.
One point of clarification, the trial judge said in the ruling after mentioning constructive trust, he said, I think the court's going to shift to a quantum merit basis for what he ought to recover. So you can argue what you think are appropriate damages at this point. What are we to make of that, and how does it affect or not affect your argument? This is...
I understand, Your Honor. I remember him saying that. The judge was not clear at the trial exactly what his findings of fact were, but in his final order, it says the court determines the granting of a constructive trust is proper as a result of the unjust enrichment of the defendants. And because that was the court's, that's 174 of the appendix, because that the court speaks through its orders, my case is in response to that rule. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Robert Hill, appearing on behalf of the Appellee with Hill and Rainey Attorneys for Cornwall Heights. I think the start of this case is that the first impression when it walked into the office was that this is a law school case. This is something that comes across in Property 1 class, and then you get out and start practicing law, and you don't think that's going to happen, and what a waste of time Property 1 was, and then here we are. But, of course, Mr. Gadberry conveniently leaves out the most important part of the factual scenario that was presented before the trial judge. And that is the whole reason that we were here. That is the whole reason that my client caused to put $23,000 worth of improvements on Mr. Washington's property, which was adjacent. And that is because the defendant willfully chose, when the county changed the addresses of the properties, he made a conscious decision that he didn't want his mom's mail to get upset or to get lost, so he kept posted on his mailbox and on the front of his house the address of the adjoining property.
Okay, so but when the counsel, will you answer Justice Powell's question that she posed earlier?
Justice Powell, if you would please repeat the question.
My question is with regard to the title search, and I think you argued in your brief that a title search would not have disclosed this.
I don't believe so. They would have searched the title to the address that's adjacent. Remember, he purchased a certain tax map number. Instead of repeating the numbers over and over again, if I could just do property A and property B, my client, in actuality, purchased property A. Correct tax map number, correct address, a title search on that property would have shown everything was proper. But the problem was, after he purchased the property, he went and put on property B the improvements. Why did he do that? Because the county, in preparation of the tax sale, took pictures of the wrong house.
Mr. Hill, Mr. Gadberry says that if he did a title search, he would have also looked at the tax maps and some other document to which he refers.
Aerial photograph?
Yes, that clearly shows that the two properties are different, and one looking at those documents would discern that they were at the wrong house. Why isn't that answered part of the constructive notice?
Well, Your Honor, I do a lot of real estate litigation, and I disagree with Mr. Gadberry that that would be part of a title search. We do not look at aerial photographs. They're not part of the chain of title.
What about the plat?
The
plat, page 396.
Your Honor, then the court can take that into consideration, but here is my point as I made in the
memorandum. That's in the chain of title, right?
I understand that, but that's not the only fact and circumstance which was presented before the trial judge in making the overall decision. You had a plaque that could be found by a title search, and who knows what his experience was. He wasn't quite
sure. Why is that one document not enough for notice?
Because, Your Honor, under the Great Atlantic case, this court specifically stated, in effect, and I gave a quote on page 9 of my memorandum, that there basically is no standard. It's up to the trial judge to consider all the facts and circumstances that were presented to this buyer when he appeared and did what he did. And the judge did that. He considered all the circumstances. Number one, there was nothing really in the evidence as to, there was no expert that testified as to chain of title and what would be found. But number two, there were other factors. There were factors of the address was right there. There were factors that the county, on their website, on the property card in the assessor's office, had a picture of Mr. Washington's house. Why? Because Mr. Washington kept the wrong address. And that is what led to all the confusion. There were numerous other factors. First of all, secondly, I also cited in my case, also Great Atlantic case, that dealt with the 5-year lease and whether or not a purchaser had to look at the terms of a lease because he was unaware of a renewal provision. This court made it clear in its ruling, not only that there was no standard, that it's really up for the court to consider all the facts and circumstances, but secondly, and most important, there must be an inquiry or red herring as to the issue at hand. My client was not making an improvement that required a survey. He was not building a garage and needed to know where the boundary line was. The issue of the boundary lines or the shape of the lot never came up. The trial court was faced with numerous factors which the court decided in the plaintiff's favor, and we believe the court should give great weight to, and we believe that that goes to the unclean hands argument as well, which means that after consideration of all the factors, my client acted reasonably. He acted the same way the county did, and he put the improvements on that property.
Does the fact that this was a tax sale as is affect the extent of diligence we ought to require?
I would argue no. If the court is going to consider that, also consider, you know, Mr. Gadberry makes a pretty big deal in the memorandum and argument before the court today that because he's experienced, well, it also means he's been through 20 to 30 of these and he's never had to get a survey, never had any problems. That's a factor to consider as well. I don't believe that increases the due diligence to answer your specific question. Nothing different than a special warranty deed or whatnot. Remember, he'd already bought the property. He was stuck with the property. That's at a tax sale where there's auction and there's bidding. And the court has the documents in the appendix that shows what his due diligence was, his handwriting, checking the assessments, checking the square footage, all determining what would be a good deal and what would be a bad deal.
Well, I guess I'm trying to understand what legal principle that you're relying on that indicates that if you have one document that gives you constructive notice of the problem, that you then weigh all this evidence that conflicts with the constructive notice that you have, and that becomes a factual question for the judge to decide. I have read Great Atlantic, but that doesn't stand for that proposition.
I would respectfully disagree. That's the way I read it. I provided the full-length quote for the court to consider. And I would respectfully disagree with Your Honor on that point. I believe it says that just like when a human being is presented with a situation, there are factors. You can't take one fact in consideration of the following constructive notice and isolate that fact and say, you're done. This was a red herring. We have other matters which give assurance to a human being and an individual who's out there living life experiences such as no one's living there. This is the address the county says. Here's the picture. There are other factors. And I believe Great Atlantic tells the trial judge to consider those factors.
Well, what about the defendant in this case? I mean, our cases have said that in a cause of action for unjust enrichment, you have to show that the defendant knew of the benefit and should reasonably have expected to repay the plaintiff. Mr. Washington didn't know anybody was even working on his house. He just comes back to his house and the guy's in there fixing stuff. And now he wants him to pay for it.
That is correct, Your Honor. Now, I don't have any cites with me, but there are other cases that apply the concept of constructive trust in actions against a defendant who did no wrongdoing.
But it has to be fraud or unjust enrichment. There certainly was not any fraud on the part of Mr. Washington. I mean, he just happened to have his house there. I mean, he didn't move it or try to trick anybody.
Well, you're...
And he didn't know people were coming around working on houses on a random basis. And he certainly, then you got to deal with unjust enrichment. And for unjust enrichment to fit, then you've got to show that he knew that this benefit was being bestowed upon him and he's got some obligation to pay for it.
That is correct, Your
Honor. So how do you get past that?
Judge, I don't think I can on that point, and that's why we had argued constructive trust, because we think this is a standard constructive trust case. Not constructive trust, excuse me, constructive fraud case. There was a representation, and that's why it's throughout the trial, made by Mr. Washington, this is this property. This is 20101 Shands Road. And he put the wrong, and knowingly put the wrong address. That creates...
Or didn't fix the address when it changed.
No. I wouldn't be here today. I'd be doing a real estate closing if he had made the choice to correct and stop that representation.
And does it matter that, in other words, he didn't put the wrong address on there, he just didn't change the address when it became incorrect?
Well, the evidence was in conflict, but I believe the better evidence in the transcript is Mr. Washington's, not my client's. My client was very honest and said, my impression in talking to Mr. Washington on that issue was that his mother had lived next door, the property that my client actually bought, and when she moved, he moved the address with him. But Mr. Washington testified at trial and also at depositions consistently that the county changed the addresses several years before. He didn't want the mail getting messed up, so he decided to keep the same address.
So he, you're talking about constructive fraud. He made no representation. He simply didn't act in response to something that the county did.
Well, Your Honor, this court has dozens upon dozens, if not hundreds, of cases on fraud that can consist of acts, words. Even on actual fraud, you have concealment, but on constructive fraud, any non-action can also constitute a representation. That's considered by this court in numerous decisions as an affirmative statement.
Not exactly.
I have a duty to potential purchasers at a tax sale to have an accurate address on my property. That's the principle that you would rely on.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think it's a question of a duty. It's a question of whether or not there is a representation. You have a duty not to pull yourself out, or your home in this case, or property, out as being of one character, whether it's an address, whether it's got a septic system, or whatnot, and misrepresent. We know for a fact that this whole case, we're here because he misrepresented the address found on the property. And it was posted on three different...
And you pled that, but that's not what the trial court did, so I don't know what we can do about that.
Well, you can send it back. The trial court never ruled on the fraud case. Never ruled against the fraud case. But if the court wishes...
Did you have an assignment of crosshair?
Your Honor, I didn't hear your question.
Did you have an assignment of crosshair?
No, I did not. If there are no further questions, that concludes the appellate's argument.
Your bottom?
There are only 2 points that I would like to make on rebuttal. The first is to emphasize the testimony of my client at trial, just so that there's no misunderstanding. Nobody moved any house numbers. His mother owned the property. She owned it for a long time. When he bought the property, either just before or just after she died, bought out his brothers and sisters, he just left the same number there. He didn't change anything. There was no evidence from either side in the trial as to exactly when the post office changed the house number. I'm not sure if the post office changed the house number or if county authorities changed the house number. But there was no evidence either way. And it's not clear in the record when he knew that there was supposed to be a one-digit change in the house number. What is clear in the record from his testimony is that this was a rural area. People knew each other. There was no question which house was the Washington family house. The mailman knew where the Washington family lived. Mr. Washington said they never had a problem with the mail. They never had to call 911. That would be the other reason you'd be concerned about your house number. You want the rescue squad coming to the right place. But they never had to deal with that.
Mr. Gadberry, there is also a basis for constructive trust that exists in our law that is independent of either fraud or improper means. And the cases say that it has been, where property has been fairly and properly acquired, but it is contrary to the principles of equity that it should be retained, that one might also impose a constructive trust. What is your response to whether the principles of equity, where perhaps this gentleman didn't do all he could have done to find this, but the number is on the wrong house, would a principle of equity indicate that perhaps it's been improperly attained?
Well, my response to that, Your Honor, would be my second point of argument in my brief, the doctrine of unclean hands, that Mr. Prasad put himself in that place. He did not have to go to Washington's house. He could have looked at his map that he had and realized which property was which. He was the one who went to the wrong property. The Washingtons never met him prior to this case coming up. They weren't actively doing anything soliciting somebody to come to their property. Prasad did it on his own. And because
does unclean hands anticipate some type of intentional wrongdoing? Does it cover negligent mistakes, unclean hands?
Yes, ma'am. I believe it does. If you put yourself in the wrong spot, then you can't blame it on somebody else. If I put myself there, I can't blame it on someone else. I have to be responsible for my own failure to do due diligence.
But isn't unclean hands, when it's used as an equitable defense, and isn't due diligence, when it's a component of a prima facie case, in the end, a fact question? And here we have a chancellor being asked for equitable remedy. It's at the very heart of the discretion of the trial court to make those kind of factual determinations. So, I mean, it seems to me that's your biggest hurdle, is that unless you can find a principle of law that takes it out of the hands of the fact finder, and there may be one, we would have to say that no reasonable chancellor could have come to this judgment, which is a pretty high standard.
Well, and, Your Honor, as I understand it, the standard of proof is plainly wrong. The evidence in this case is that the trial court was plainly wrong in the determination, and they should not have awarded a constructive trust based on my arguments made in the brief. I see my red light is flashing. The only other thing I would like to say is that no one should ever buy real estate without a title.
Call the next case.